young Palestinian man is killed in yet another Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank. A group of Australian MPs plan to visit the U.S. to lobby against efforts to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Also in the headlines, Niger's military government says it is in negotiations for a very swift withdrawal of French forces from the country. Welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Israeli forces have carried out fresh raid on a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, killing one young Palestinian man. Our correspondent Monica Ndil joined us earlier with the details.
Israeli forces raided this morning the refugee camp of Nur Shams near Tul Karen, northern the occupied West Bank, and 21-year-old young Palestinian Ayed Abu Harb was shot and killed during the Israeli military raid. Today in the Nur Shams refugee camp, we are speaking about at least one Palestinian had been killed. Ayed was shot in the head, according to the Palestinian paramedics there in the refugee camp. A number of Palestinians had been wounded as well. It's not the and during this operation, according to the residents of the refugee camp, the Palestinian fighters succeeded to detonate an explosive device, and this is what the Israeli military had convinced. They issued a statement saying that a large explosive device was detonated under one of the Israeli military bulldozers, and there were footage coming from the scene showing the explosion. So every time the Israeli troops are raiding the areas, killing people in cold blood, arresting people, including women, elderly, and children, the Palestinian resistance groups are there trying their utmost with everything they have.
Hamas has slammed as a serious escalation the latest Israeli violations in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil, including abuses against Palestinian women. The Palestinian Resistance Movement also warned that such aggression will not go unanswered. Hamas said the crimes show that Israel is a rogue regime that does not respect any international law. It also criticized international silence and inaction in the face of such an aggression. Hamas, however, stressed that Israel will fail to stop Palestinian resistance and struggle for freedom. The Islamic Jihad, the other Palestinian resistance movement based in Gaza, also called for an intensification of armed retaliatory operations against Israeli targets. Israeli media reported on Monday that during a raid into a home in Al-Khalil in July, Israeli troops forced five Palestinian women to strip and to walk naked before them. Earlier, we were joined by journalist and political analyst Julia Qassem. She says Israel has been committing crimes against humanity since the beginning of its occupation of Palestine 7 decades ago.
Since the occupation began, since the atrocities of the Israeli settlers against the Palestinians began 7-8 decades ago, it has been marked by extreme brutality and extreme and the unthinkable crimes of the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. But again, these crimes against humanity, against women and children, they come up because there is no legitimate basis for this occupation. So they have to maintain their control over their occupation by through these means of terror and through these means of senseless criminality, especially as they are unable to confront the Palestinian resistance that is making the military aspect of the Israeli occupation weaker and weaker every day. So they had to commit this heinous crime of breaking into this house and actually forcing these women to strip in front of the children. I read what the story was, and while being threatened with guard dogs, it's really, really just unthinkable how low that they're willing to stoop to maintain any shred of control over the occupation and to attempt to humiliate and attack the very honor and dignity of the Palestinian women.
A group of Australian lawmakers will visit the U.S. later this month to demand an end to Washington's push to get WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange extradited to the country.
I think it's really, really important that we do keep up the pressure on the U.S. government and that we convey to American citizens how strongly Australians feel about this issue. I think everything that we can do can make a change, and it would be remiss of us not to make every effort that we can on Mr. Assange's behalf. We understand that he's in really poor health. And I think that's a real, really acute concern. And I think it is time, as I said earlier, enough is enough, and it's time to bring Julian Assange home to Australia. He should not be extradited to the United States.
Ryan cited surveys saying more than 9 out of 10 Australians think that Assange should now come home. The lawmaker added that the Australian government needs to protect its citizen, who is, in her words, responsible only for acts of journalism. The comments on the travel plan come ahead of a visit by the Australian Premier to the U.S. Assange has been confined in a UK jail since April 2019 after losing the protection of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he had taken refuge. He is wanted in the US for espionage after leaking classified documents related to war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq on his whistleblower website. If convicted, he could face up to 175 years in jail. Niger's military-appointed prime minister has once again called for the swift withdrawal of French forces from his country.
The government has already denounced the agreements that allow them to be on our territory. They are in an illegal position, and I think that the exchanges that are underway should very quickly enable these forces to withdraw from our country.
Zane's comments came as anti-French sentiments remain high in the coup-hit West African nation. Nigerians have been staging rallies for days to demand France withdraw its forces stationed at a military base in the capital Niamey. The premier also touched upon the order for the French ambassador to leave Niger. He said the envoy displayed an attitude of contempt by refusing to meet the junta leaders.
I asked the Minister of Foreign Affairs here to send an official message inviting him to come and exchange views with us to see what measures could be taken to bring about a settlement, de-escalation as we call it. He refused to do so. That's contemptuous behavior on his part, and it's not acceptable.
The French President Emmanuel Macron has defied Niger's order for his ambassador to leave. Also, Paris has refused to acknowledge the military leaders as the legitimate government after a coup in late July. That is while Niger has cut military coordination with French forces. There are around 1,500 French troops in the Sahel state. Niger is one of the 6 former French colonies in Africa to have faced a military coup in the last 3 years.
Anti-French sentiment is high in Niger as thousands gathered outside the French military base in the capital Niamey to demand the withdrawal of French forces and its ambassadors from the African country. Wearing and waving Niger's flag, demonstrators chanted anti-French slogan, expressing their full support for the country's military government. The demonstrators demanded that Western countries, especially France, respect their choice.
Not our sole demand.
Our only request, our ultimate request, is the departure. The departure. The departure of the French who are on Niger territory. We don't need these people here. We don't need, and we repeat, we are ready to die to defend our homeland. We are ready to die to get them out. They must leave. We don't need them here.
We're here and we'll be here forever, until the day France packs up, and packs up it will, I tell you. France has to move out because it's not its country, it's our country, it's our territory, and well, France has to move out.
The anger in Niger grew especially after the French president said his country did not recognize the military government there. Emmanuel Macron has said he's in regular contact with Niger's deposed president Mohamed Bazoum. Nigerian junta has blasted Macron's comments, saying their remarks constitute blatant interference in their domestic affairs. But regardless of those reactions, the European Union said it was imposing sanctions against the military junta in Niger as part of efforts to force its leaders to hand over power to a civilian rule.
We have also decided to initiate a process for the establishment of a legal framework for individual sanctions against the putschists, and we are ready to listen to other suggestions from ECOWAS. They explained to us the situation on the ground and how ECOWAS is considering the possibility of a military deployment on the ground.
And instead of expressing support for the people of Niger, who have been under the French colonial rule for decades, Borrell expressed a bloc solidarity with Paris.
The ministers reiterated the strong condemnation of the military coup in Niger, called for the release of President Bazoum and his family, and to go back to the constitutional order. This is something that has been involving, in particular, France. We express our solidarity with France.
Anti-French sentiment has been running high across Africa, with countries like Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Mali already driving out French troops from their soil. Niger also seems determined to put an end to the French military presence, as it blames the European country for growing insecurity, worsening political instability, and armed insurgencies.
The anger and resentment in Niger comes as the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, under the direct influence of France, has threatened to deploy military force in the West African nation in an effort to reinstate ousted President Bazoum. That after the military junta took power following a coup on July 26 and placed President Bazoum under house arrest in what many describe as an anti-French revolution in Niger. But what is the root cause of all that hatred against France? Over the years, Niger has faced growing insecurity amid worsening effects of political instability and armed insurgencies. At the same time, the West African nation, a resource-rich country of 26 million, is, according to UN figures, considered one of the poorest nations on Earth. Given that the French have been playing a crucial role in Niger, both politically and economically, the general public points its finger at Paris to be the cause of all its grievances. But Niger is not the only country facing growing anti-French sentiment. The hatred against France has been a common feeling amongst many African countries, given that the military takeover in Niger is the sixth in the Sahel region in less than 3 years, coming after Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Mali. The toppling of President Bazoum has, in a way, created shockwaves not only across Africa, but reverberated across Europe. That's due to the fact that Niger is home to its strategic mineral reserves, such as uranium, gold, and crude oil, among others. The interesting point, though, is that France holds mineral rights for the mining of uranium, which powers its nuclear power plant. This has made Paris highly depend on Niger's uranium mines. But being aware of the strategic importance of uranium to France's energy needs, Niger military leaders have already announced that they will suspend the export of uranium and gold to France and the United States. The move is widely seen by many across Niger as a way to cut the hands of powers that have long been plundering the country's resources. Knowing that the same fate would be waiting for many across other Sahelian countries, African people are waking up to the fact that Western powers, namely France, have been maintaining their presence in their countries merely to plunder their resources. That's maybe the reason for Nigerians and other West African countries to come to the fact that the era of colonialism is over and they are the ones who should put an end to the decades of West's occupation and economic exploitation of their countries.
The Russian Defense Ministry says three Ukrainian drones flying near the Moscow region have been shot down by the country's air defenses. The ministry said two of the drones were destroyed over the Kaluga and the Tver regions, which are close to the capital, Moscow. The drone debris fell in a village which is home to an official residence palace of the Russian president. Another drone was intercepted and brought down over Istra district, but caused minor damage to a facility. Almost 50 flights were canceled or postponed from four airports around the capital. Kiev has increased cross-border drone attacks in recent weeks, mostly targeting Moscow. Russia, in response, has conducted drone strikes also, including on the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. The Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Turkish counterpart Recep Tayyip Erdogan held a meeting in Sochi. The two sides discussed bilateral relations, joint projects, the grain deal, and the situation in Ukraine. Marina Kurtanova reports from the Russian capital.
Erdogan arrived in Sochi on the eve of the G20 summit. This was his first visit to Russia since his re-election in May. The Turkish official began the meeting with his Russian counterpart by expressing gratitude for Moscow's assistance in extinguishing forest fires and also efforts in eliminating the consequences of a powerful February earthquake. The two sides continued with the topic of the gas hub, which is also their common project. But it was clear that the topic of Ukraine and the grain deal were the main items on the agenda of Recep Tayyip Erdogan in the trip.
We are determined to continue efforts to establish lasting peace, stability and prosperity in our region. We previously hosted the direct negotiations between the conflicting parties. As before, we are ready to do our best and act as a mediator.
Erdogan arrived on the eve of the G20 summit in New Delhi. Therefore, the issue of the grain deal was also raised, from which Russia withdrew, since not a single promise given by the Western partners was fulfilled. Putin noted that the withdrawal of Russia does not affect the food crisis. In addition, Russia is ready to come up with several initiatives at once.
We intend to organize the supply of 1 million ton of grain from Russia at a preferential price for processing to Turkey and then free transportation to the poor countries. In this sense, we count on the help from the Qatari state, who is ready to support the poorest countries for humanitarian reasons.
According to the Russian leader, the initiative is not a replacement for the grain deal, but would make a great contribution to solving the food problem in the African countries. The visit by the Turkish president turned out to be quite short, just a few hours, and no documents were signed.
Turkey's hopes to extend the grain deal did not come true. However, Moscow and Ankara are already engaged in several joint projects. Russia is building the Akuyu nuclear power plant, and the state of the gas hub, which diversifies Russian gas supplies to Europe, also depends on Moscow. Russia is actively supporting Turkey in various sectors of the national economy, ranging from banking to metallurgy. Marina Kurtunova, Moscow.
In China, thousands of people have been evacuated as a typhoon made landfall in the country's southeastern coastal areas. Typhoon Haikui brought intense rains and winds to eastern Fujian province and southern Guangdong province after wreaking havoc in Taiwan. Authorities say some 115,000 people were evacuated from high-risk areas. According to the National Weather Forecaster, Haikui lost strength and became a tropical storm after its landfall early Monday. Many flights were canceled and businesses closed ahead of the storm. Haikui made landfall after another storm named Saola left a trail of destruction in mainland China and Hong Kong. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
It's no secret there is a serious homelessness problem in the United States, which has assumed alarming proportions in recent years, from rough sleeping to being chronically homeless to living in crowded makeshift accommodations. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, a quick trip through any major American city and you can see it for yourself. Tent cities, underneath highways or alongside parks, people sleeping on the sidewalk, overcrowded and resource-stripped shelters. It is estimated that there are nearly 600,000 homeless people across the U.S., marking the highest yearly surge since the government began tracking the data in 2007, according to the Wall Street Journal. Major cities like Los Angeles are seeing homeless populations spike almost 10% from last year. This problem has been deeply exacerbated in the post-pandemic era. Prior to the COVID-19 outbreak, rent was already skyrocketing due to inflation levels, as well as development projects forcing long-time residents, mainly minorities, out of their own neighborhoods. The pandemic halted the U.S. economy, at least for the working class, for several months, and thus rent protections had to be placed primarily across the state levels. With Americans out of jobs and back pay piling up on rent, the then Donald Trump administration released three rounds of stimulus checks over the course of a year, totaling around $3,200 for most individuals. Deeply insufficient, this rent would likely only cover 1 month's worth of rent in most major cities. The average monthly rent for a one-bedroom New York City apartment is just over $2,000. The Biden administration focused on returning things back to normal and beating the pandemic, mostly for a political goal, without addressing the reality that millions of Americans face. Not only did rent protections come crashing down without addressing the hundreds of millions of dollars owed in back pay, but the Biden administration cut essential benefits like SNAP benefits, which kicked millions off food stamps. We'll be right back.
A study showed these benefits reduce poverty by 10% and even child poverty by 14%. Declaring the end of the pandemic and the victory over COVID-19 was no doubt a political victory for the Biden administration, but in doing so, it forced thousands of Americans out of their homes and into the streets. The COVID-era protections, which prove the federal government is capable of working with the state governments to fight poverty and protect people, did not put things back to normal, but returned thousands of people to the same issues with worse conditions. Adding to the diminishing conditions is the threat of a looming recession. Inflation has driven up the cost of basic living in the United States: groceries, gas, electricity. So while SNAP benefits are being cut, costs of the very same items those benefits were helping ordinary Americans out with are rising. Then comes the blame game. Federal authorities shift the blame to local authorities and local policy failures when it comes to the rapidly growing homeless population. Local authorities blame the lack of federal leadership in curtailing the nationwide issue. Perhaps the only people taking serious steps to fight the homelessness crisis are average, everyday Americans. Groups like Bring Chicago Home take a multi-pronged approach to addressing homelessness crisis at a local level. Creating a policy that would house the 65,000 homeless people living in Chicago, the group has also disrupted then-Mayor Lori Lightfoot multiple times throughout various meetings, demanding that she take action. Their tactics so far have been a success. Now, Mayor Brandon Johnson has adopted the Bring Chicago Home initiative, using real estate taxes for programs to end homelessness. The success of these policies is yet to be seen, but this initiative would not have seen the light of day if it weren't for community organizations. A similar community pushback is also seen in New York. The New York City Rent Board intended to pass a 2-5% rent increase across major areas of the city. Local activists stormed the stage with city council members to demand the increase be stopped. Instead of hearing what renters have to say, New York City Mayor Adams supported the decision of the board and the rent hike was passed. Throughout major metropolitan cities from liberal California all the way to conservative Florida, it has been the same story over and over again. It is indeed a stark reality. Americans who are themselves struggling and living payback to paycheck are the ones taking care of each other and fighting for each other. It may seem like the issue is beyond Washington's grasp, but the reality is that if it wanted to, Washington could solve the homelessness issue overnight. There are currently 16 million homes completely vacant across the United States. With only 500,000 homeless people, there is more than plenty of housing available for the homeless. One could argue that these homes are not exactly where there are homeless people, but that is not true. A good chunk of these homes are within the city limits of most major cities, and even then, a relocation program would not cost much at all. Speaking of things that do not cost much, solving the homelessness issue itself would cost very little. According to advocacy to alleviate homelessness, it would cost just over $20 billion to end the crisis. In isolation, this amount seems like a lot, but let's look at how the Biden administration has spent money. $43 billion on military aid alone to Ukraine. This omits billions of dollars in financial aid, food aid, logistics, etc. $10 billion on federal stimulus to bolster already militarized police. $80 billion on public prisons and jails. The money spent on policing and prisons is worth taking particular notice of, as homelessness itself is treated as a crime. Even in the freezing winter, law enforcement across the U.S. often engage in mass sweeps of homeless camps, tearing down tents, and throwing away what little personal belongings they have. Politicians and some business owners in various areas complain that the tents and homeless people themselves aren't attractive and prevent people from coming to their towns or businesses. Ironically, it's often these very businesses that drive the cost of living in an area and price people out of their homes. So, instead of alleviating the crisis through fixed price renting, the solution taken on by local authorities is to not only evict people from their homes, but drive them from the area completely. The Chicago Coalition for the Homeless reports, in the past few months, we have witnessed city crews threaten to ticket people for sleeping on the sidewalk in uptown, force elderly and disabled people to move their property in the middle of the winter for no apparent reason, bulldoze a tent city while seizing tents that looked almost new and recently occupied, and attempt to seize the tent of a homeless man who was present and asserting that the tent belonged to him. The threat of homelessness is not going away in the United States. As the economy dwindles and more Americans are forced into living paycheck to paycheck, federal to state governments throw money at criminalization of the homeless instead of actually solving homelessness. The authorities believe that homelessness can't be an issue if nobody sees it. But the reality is everyone sees it. It is a societal crisis. Many feel that they could be next, as more than half of Americans are one paycheck away from homelessness. And with the cost of living skyrocketing, saving money is also becoming a challenge. With real leadership that values human life over profits, perhaps one day Americans will be able to solve the homelessness crisis. But until then, they should not rely on their current political leadership, whether Democrat or Republican, to do anything substantial. The only way forward is for the American people to organize together and take an offensive approach to solving their own problems.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Gabon is a rich country in Central Africa, which has been ruled by the same family for 56 years. The Bongo family, first father Omar and then son Ali, have been the presidents of this country since 1967 until the August 30th coup. On Monday, the military leader of the coup, General Brice Oligui-Nguema, was sworn in as the country's transitional president. On this edition of The Spotlight, we'll take a look at future possibilities for the country of Gabon. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Inam Richardson, organizer, All African People's Revolutionary Party out of San Francisco, California. And Harley Schlanger, spokesman of La Rouge, organization out of Potsdam, Germany. Thank you both for being with me. I'd like to start this off in San Francisco with NM. In my opening, I mentioned that Gabon is a rich country. But what about the average citizen there? Have the majority of the people benefited from those riches?
We have to understand that Gabon is a super exploited country that's been pillaged for a very long time, especially by France, its former colonizer. So the Bongo family, which was in power for 56 years, was able to maintain a certain level of personal and familial wealth through cutting certain illegal deals with France, French politicians, and French enterprises. One notable example is the Elf scandal. Elf has now been rebranded as Total, but it's France's primary energy company. Gabon is very rich in petroleum, as well as uranium, and France has long benefited from those resources. The Bongo family, which has been historically allied with France, has benefited from those resources, but the masses of Gabonese people have not seen any sort of material improvement in their lives through these resources.
Well, Harley, the Bongo reign was filled with corruption and theft. Former President Ali Bongo is said to be one of the richest men in Africa, with a net worth of over $1 billion. With this track record, your perspective of how the Bongo family was able to hold on to power for so long?
Well, first of all, they had the support of the French. And this is extremely important because the idea of France-Afrique, the French control of the former African colonies, they never really ended colonialism. And Bongo is an example, the family is an example of people who benefited from a very tight alliance with French corporations. The previous speaker mentioned the Total connection. Look, Gabon is the second richest per capita country in Africa, but the mass of the population lives in poverty. And this is typical of French West Africa. But what we're seeing now is an awakening of people in Africa. The coups are an example of nationalists in the military acting on behalf of the people. Now, what will happen ultimately in Gabon is still up in the air. There are rumors out, spread probably by the French, that this coup is run by leaders who are trying to work with the French. But I think we're seeing a new period where leaders are emboldened to say, we will not be subservient to your colonial powers anymore. And that's the reality in Gabon, where the people are out in the streets supporting the coup.
Okay, well, the coup took place because, according to coup leaders, they disputed the legitimacy of the recent election, which had renamed Ali Bongo as president. Your thoughts in general, was this coup really because of the election results, or would it have taken place regardless, in your perspective?
Well, I think there's still a lot that remains to be seen with this coup. We know that the people certainly want to have a leader like Assimi Goïta of Mali or Ibrahim Traoré of Burkina Faso, and we do certainly hope that Nguema follows in the footsteps of these other coup leaders who have expelled certain French institutions within their country. However, there are reports, as the previous speaker mentioned, that Nguema does have ties to the Bongo's inner circle. And one thing that we saw was that Bongo, before he left power, suspended French media. So it suggests that maybe there was some tension that was developing between that relationship. And Nguema has reinstated the French media. So France 24 and RFI, Radio France International, are now operating again. So I think there's still a lot that we need to see in regards to how things unfold. But certainly, the masses of the people are waiting for the type of leadership that we've seen in these other coups that have taken a very clear position against the former colonizer and have begun to seek out genuine partnerships for their states that have the interests of the people in mind.
Well, Harley, I want to bring up something that NM talked about, that it's early to see the direction of this coup and who this new president really is. I mean, there are reports that General Nguema, who is a cousin to the Bongos, also is a millionaire, and some say perhaps even propped up by the West. I mean, your thoughts on this overall and a possibility?
Well, I think the West is acting very stupidly overall, given the situation that's taking place in Africa, especially after the recent conclusion of the BRICS summit. What we're seeing now is the Global South is going through a second phase of decolonization. The first decolonization, especially in the French countries, was a fake, that they granted a cover of independence, but they put in power people who were totally dependent on France for military, for credit. They put these countries under the control of the international banking institutions. And those banking institutions were primarily predatory looters who insisted on no spending on infrastructure, on education, healthcare, and so on in those countries. So regardless whether this coup is totally real or not, there's a process underway that's unstoppable. That is, nations asserting their right to sovereignty, meaning governments that defend the interests of their people. So it's really the ball is in the court of the people in these countries. That's why it's so important to see these demonstrations, to see people in the streets saying, we will not be colonies anymore. And this is something whether Blinken and Biden and Macron think they can put the genie back in the bottle or control it with some new cover story. It's not going to work, especially given the power and the enthusiasm internationally in the Global South for what happened in Johannesburg, South Africa with the BRICS conference last week.
Well, in speaking of the colonial rule, I want to look at that a little bit more, because what a lot of people perhaps do not realize about the French role and the colonial tax that has definitely contributed to the poverty, not only in Gabon, but in 13 other African countries, which have to give France 85% of their annual income. I want to talk about that. If you can open that up a little bit and explain about this colonial tax and the effects that this has had on the African continent.
That's a really important question, and I don't think it's talked about enough. So I'm currently in San Francisco, but my primary residence is in Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, one of the 14 countries. We can say 15 if we include Comoros, which has a similar system under a different name, that uses this currency called the CFA franc. This currency grants France enormous power. Not only are a significant portion of our national reserves held in the French Treasury in Paris, but France also has voting and veto power in the regional banks of both West and Central Africa. So as these African states are diversifying their partners, choosing to align with interests that are more strategic and less neocolonial in nature, there are certain powers that France still has to block certain economic exchanges, which is why on the ground in countries that have had some of these coups, like in Burkina Faso and in Mali, the masses of people are now demanding that this question of the currency be addressed. And so I really think this is going to be the next step. Now that we've seen some of these governments expel the military and crack down on French media propaganda, I think the next move will be to start really looking to create a sovereign currency that doesn't allow for France to have this level of direct economic control within our economies.
Well, I want to look at that. Harley, you talked about the international banking system. I want to look at the role of a lot of these international organizations in propping up this type of neocolonialism on the African country, African continent. We see, as I said, allowing 85% of the annual income of these countries to be put in French treasuries that these countries had little access or a small access to their own money, and also loans and so many other things that we've seen with these international organizations, especially the banking institutions. Your thoughts on the role that these international organizations have played in helping the settler colonial states continue their neocolonialism?
The International Monetary Fund should be shut down. It's an agency that works on behalf of private banks and corporate interests to make sure that debt is paid first, and more importantly, that the debt keeps growing, that the service, the interest on the debt, requires more and more resources. And look, here's the point. The countries that are having these coups in Africa are very wealthy when it comes to raw materials, but the raw materials are not available for the people to use them in that country. Instead, they're shipped to the mother country. And in this case, take the case of Niger. Niger is the largest uranium producer for France. 70% of France's electricity comes from uranium. Only 15 to 20% of the population of Niger have electricity on a daily basis. So what the Global South countries are saying is these resources should be used and developed in our own countries for the benefit of our own people. They're not opposing trade, but they're talking about fair terms. Under the IMF, under the World Economic Forum policy of deindustrialization, under the World Bank, the investment is not allowed in physical economy in these countries. So their resources are not part of the wealth of the people. And this is what was discussed by Dilma Rousseff, who's the president of the New Development Bank of BRICS. She said this bank will generate credit for and by the countries of themselves, and they'll use national currencies as opposed to having to change their currencies to dollars, which puts them at an additional disadvantage. So we're seeing a revolution internationally. The French don't like it. The United States doesn't like it. But I think this is going to be unstoppable.
In it, we have seen strong African leaders in the past who wanted to fight for their countries or the continent's sovereignty. And we have seen them overthrown in coups. We have seen them being assassinated. Your take on this, I mean, we see the situation, especially if we look at what is happening in Niger or Burkina Faso. Your thoughts on that and the role of these entities such as the United States and France in trying to turn around this progress by these countries?
Well, I think this is inevitable. If we look at Western economies, I mean, their economies, the foundations are heavily based off of the exploitation of the Global South and Africa in particular. I mean, Niger is a prime example. It's a great one. We have a country that is very rich in uranium, and a third of French households historically have relied on Niger's uranium to light up, you know, to for basic electricity. The Eiffel Tower itself, a symbol of France, is also relies on uranium for Niger to supply its energy source. Meanwhile, Niger is a country where the majority of people don't have access to electricity. So when we look at the way Western states act, like the United States, like France, you know, they act in their interest and they carry out what coups, they carry out assassinations, they rig elections. They're implicated in all of this. It's a lot of it's declassified. Oftentimes they'll confess to it, but African people lack the power right now to defend ourselves. This is a part of the reason why Mali and Burkina Faso have been calling for an African federation. The people on the grassroots level understand this to be Pan-Africanism, and they're calling for a unified Africa, understanding that if Africa unites, that they'll be in a position to defend themselves. But when African states go about this alone in isolation, there does tend to be, you know, some sort of coup against a popular leader, some sort of assassination, or some other attempt at regime change. It's an ongoing cycle that African states have been through since independence.
Well, Harley, your take on that, and I'm talked about the importance of solidarity with these African states. Now, we have seen a growing number of states actually come together and say that, for example, they would not allow Niger to be attacked. At the same time, we have other African nations, part of the African Union, for example, who a lot of their leaders are in the hands of the West, who say they want to attack. So it seems like the West is continuing their very strong and long-lived policy of divide and conquer. Where do you see this going right now? Do you think that, as you said, this momentum has started and will continue? Or do you see more and more interference by the West, perhaps through some of the proxy leaders that they have on the African continent?
Well, I expect there'll be more interference, but the question is, will it be able to succeed? Let's take a classic case of this, the case of Gaddafi and Libya, where Gaddafi was moving to use the oil resources of Libya to improve the standard of living, to build universities, new cities, water projects. Libya was moving into the modern era, and the U.S., under the direction of the, in this case, the British and the French, carried out a regime change coup, including a murder of President Gaddafi. What was his real crime? He was talking about a unified African currency backed by gold and oil. Now, let's learn the lesson from that. The problem of, as you mentioned, if there's no solidarity, you can pick nations apart one after another, make special deals, work out projects where you promise money to a leader and basically bribe them, like we see with the U.S. and Zelensky in Ukraine. Now, what's changed is that we've gone past the point of no return. The idea of sovereignty is at the center of the biggest battle on the planet right now, which is the proxy war against Russia in Ukraine, because Russia stands for sovereignty, national sovereignty. So do the Chinese. And for them, sovereignty is a question of the economic development of a nation and the right of the people of that nation to benefit from their own labor, their own resources, and so on. So that's what the fight is about. And I think with the BRICS, with the New Development Bank, with the fact that the West hasn't been able to succeed in backing down Russia or China, and the fact that you have more countries, 40 countries, applying for membership in the BRICS, including a number of African countries. And of course, Ethiopia and Egypt were added to the BRICS. So this is a fundamental change in modern history. And as I said, it's a second stage of decolonization. I don't think they can stop it without massive bloodshed. The question is, will the people of France, will the people of the United States support French and Americans dying in Africa for the sake of oil companies, raw material cartels, and so on?
Hmm. Well, in your perspective, is there a difference between the coup, for example, in Niger and the one in Gabon?
Well, I think it's really early to tell. But I guess I'll say that I have, it seems that there's a difference in some of the response to the coups, which is a bit concerning. So, for example, Borrell spoke out saying that, you know, as bad as coups are, in his opinion, we have to understand the context of Gabon differently because the elections are rigged. And so it's like we're seeing a little bit of some of the tune being changed, which is a bit concerning. But I do think it's still early to tell. And I do think what the other guest is saying is very important, which is that really what we're seeing in a lot of African states right now is that leadership is oftentimes forced to be submissive to the will of the people because there's so much clarity on the level of the masses in terms of what they want. Their demands have become so clear. So I think we still have to wait and see. Is Nguema somebody who is aligned with the West? Is he somebody who is going to take some of the steps that Tchani in Niger has already taken? Niger, for example, is kicking the ambassador, the French ambassador, out. He's refusing to leave. They've cut his electricity. They've cut water to the French embassy. You know, they've already dissolve the French military court. So they've very quickly taken some of these steps. I think, you know, time will tell what direction Gabon heads in, but definitely this is what the people want. And you know, we definitely, of course, hope that Nguema understands that, you know, right now, you know, we're not in a time and place where there's a possibility of clinging on to power and also supporting or aligning closely with Africa's former colonizers. That's not where the masses are at right now. And I really don't think they'll put up with that if that is something that is a possibility.
Well, Harley, your perspective, what will it take for the coup in Gabon to transcend into a type of government that the people of that country want?
Collaboration with their neighbors, which is already taking place. Collaboration with the bigger neighbors, with energy, with power. Now, one of the problems in that area is Nigeria, which is heavily influenced by the British. But even in Nigeria, the push to get ECOWAS to intervene in Niger has run into real problems. So on the one hand, you have the neighborhood, which is resistant now to going back to the old colonialism. But that's why I say we have to have a broader international perspective, because this world is changing dramatically. We see it with the China-Iran trade deals. We see it with Iran and Saudi Arabia and Rapprochement. We see it with the use of national currencies moving towards an alternative to a dollar system. And one of the few powers that the Western banks have is sanctions, seizing money, seizing resources. How are they going to do that with every single country in revolt? So I think this is where we can say that if the regime in Gabon wants to become a democratic regime and do what's right for its people, it cannot go back to the same deals they've had with French corporate cartels. And it has to act to do things such as infrastructure development, providing electricity, healthcare, roads, connections, internet. These are things they can do. And if they do it, then the impulse of the people will be with them. And I think that's what your other guest is pointing out. The people don't want more colonialism. They want freedom. They don't want to be subservient to Paris or to London or to Wall Street. And that's the change that's taking place in the world.
Yes, the change from that unilateral to that multilateral world. Well, thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. Adam Richardson, organizer of All African People's Revolutionary Party out of San Francisco, California. Harley Schenker, spokesman of La Rouge organization out of Potsdam, Germany. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, thanking you for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Ata, the host of this program. Brother Suhail is with me in the studio for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Suhail. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam. Thank you very much.